Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Not to point fingers or anything, but that whole global economic collapse, it was us. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice, over 10,000 independent insurance agencies across America committed to treating customers as people, not policies, online at trustedchoice.com. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear unique perspectives on global events and American culture at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 22nd of April. Good to have you here. With the economy the way it is, just having a job is something to be grateful for. But don't you kind of wonder whether Timothy Geithner, late at night and all alone, quietly asks himself if he'd be better off doing something else? Well, after a speech in Washington this morning, the Treasury Secretary was asked that very question.
I feel deeply privileged, as I said, to have this moment.
Once laughter died down, Geithner kept on going. He said it's the United States that is to blame for the financial mess the world finds itself in. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
Here's how Geithner put it.
I feel a deep sense of obligation, particularly given the responsibility America bears for this crisis, to be part of this effort with this president and this Congress trying to fix this crisis and get us back to the position where the government of the United States is doing a better job of managing our country's economic fortunes.
In the lead-up to the G20 meetings in Washington this weekend, Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute says that statement is significant.
It's a very important thing to say. First, it's true, as everyone outside the United States recognizes.
And Huffbauer says the U.S. still needs lots of help fixing this mess. Last month, G20 countries promised to pass regulatory reforms and pledged to give the IMF $1.1 trillion for loans to developing countries. But the heavy lifting, appropriating that money and passing the new laws, hasn't started. And Huffbauer believes there's an even bigger challenge, our trade deficit. For years, foreigners haven't wanted to buy what we make, so they've bought our debt instead. That's pushed interest rates down, making it easy for consumers to borrow even more. First, that seems like a good thing, leading to low mortgage rates, for instance.
So it does lead to the good things that you've talked about, and we've kind of gorged on good things.
Now, Huffbauer worries if we don't do something to fix our deficits, the temptation to borrow beyond our means will still be there when the economy recovers. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
President Obama is having another one of his sit-downs with bank executives tomorrow. No bonuses and bailouts this time, though. Tomorrow, it's going to be credit cards and all those fees and restrictions the big card companies hit consumers with. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has more now on what could be the next big thing to hit this economy.
First came foreclosures, now come the credit card defaults. Credit card companies are writing off more bad debt than ever, and the delinquency rate has soared past 6%. Robert Manning is the author of Credit Card Nation.
When the first bubble of housing burst, the ability now for people to pay down their credit cards through mortgage refinancings are gone.
Manning says banks rely heavily on credit cards for profits. With default rates rising and consumers spending less, banks are trying to squeeze as much money as they can out of cardholders. Nick Bork heads up the Pew Safe Credit Cards Project. It just completed a two-year study of the credit card industry.
We found that all of them use practices which the Federal Reserve has recently deemed unfair and deceptive.
Things like jacking up consumers' interest rates and fees with no notice. That's what happened to retired school teacher Iris Rosenberg. The Miami resident paid off most of her credit card debt and always met her minimum payments. Even so, Bank of America more than doubled her interest rate to 29%, and American Express canceled her card.
I had just paid them a large amount toward what I owed, almost all of it, and then to be canceled. It's like they got my money and that was it. I mean, they just totally dumped me.
Momentum is building on Capitol Hill to reform the credit card industry. Two such bills are working their way through Congress, and new credit card regulations will kick in next year. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Roche closed on its acquisition of Genentech not too long ago, but today the Swiss pharmaceutical giant is probably wishing it could have a do-over. Roche was betting big that Genentech's cancer drug Avastin would be approved for a new application. But early results from a set of clinical trials show Avastin does not prevent the recurrence of colon cancer, as everybody had hoped. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin has more now on what happens when a blockbuster drug fizzles out.
Avastin is one of Roche's best-selling drugs. Its global sales are expected to reach about $6 billion this year. But if this clinical trial had gone better, sales could have doubled by 2011. Now, they probably won't. Analyst George Farmer at Canaccord Adams says Avastin was a key reason Roche paid $95 a share for Genentech, Avastin's creator. Now, Farmer says Roche may have rushed the deal.
Near term, it looks like they might have made a mistake. Roche probably overpaid for Genentech, but Genentech's a phenomenal company.
Last year, the three top-selling cancer drugs came out of Genentech. There's been a flood of pharmaceutical mergers in recent months. The industry is trying to streamline costs to put more money into developing new drugs. But analyst Les Funtleiter with Miller Tabak says cutting costs doesn't always make that happen.
In the past, mergers have not created value in pharmaceutical land, because the more money you pour into R&D does not necessarily mean the more products you get out.
Roche pushed for the Genentech merger before the clinical trial results were released. Roche assumed the trial would go well and it would have to pay even more for Genentech. Now, analyst George Farmer says the poor outcome could affect future pharmaceutical mergers.
Clearly, they were taking on a lot of risk, and I don't think you're going to see those kinds of deals anymore.
But the Roche-Genentech deal may look more promising by June. That's when complete data from the Avastin trial will be revealed. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, 89 people commit suicide in this country every day. Today, only one of them made national news. David Kellerman, the acting chief financial officer at Freddie Mac, the bailed-out mortgage company, was found dead in his Northern Virginia home early this morning. Neither the bank nor local officials have made any connections between Freddie Mac's problems and Kellerman's death. On Wall Street today, the major indices lost ground. We will have the details when we do the numbers. It's going to be a busy weekend in Washington. Not only is Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner hosting his counterparts from the world's largest economies, they're having yet another meeting on the worldwide recession, but the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are having their annual spring meetings, too. Last year, as the dimensions of this recession were becoming more clear, Robert Zoellick, the president of the World Bank, warned against leaving the developing world out of any recovery plans. Earlier today, I asked him what's changed for the poorest countries in the world as the financial crisis and the recession have gotten worse.
What you saw start in the financial sector in the United States and in the developed world, and then has spread to what economists, you know, call the real economy, the manufacturing, services, others, then flows through those sectors in the developing world. And so it depends. If you're a textile producer, there'll be a big drop in sales. In Africa, many of the commodity producers have been hurt. If you have a great dependence on remittances from foreign workers in Africa and Latin America, those have really dried up.
This week, the World Bank announced a new series of social protection programs, $12 billion worth for the developing world. What do you hope to get done with this, and what else are you going to do now?
Well, the starting point is we're trying to learn some of the lessons from prior crises, for example, that in Latin America in the 80s and East Asia in the 90s. And one of the lessons is that you may recall there were the big balance of payments packages often put together by the IMF. Those are very important, but what we saw in those crises is that if you didn't focus on safety net policies, so nutrition issues, school feeding programs, it really could have an effect for a generation. So we're trying to push forward a more aggressive agenda depending on a country's capacity in that area.
You know, a couple of weeks ago before the G20, you stressed that there is responsibility among the leading economies to do something for the developing world. And you asked them actually to set up this thing you call the Vulnerability Fund, to set aside some money to help those countries out. Any luck with that?
Yeah, what the key point is, what I've been trying to emphasize is that you know, this needs to be more than a discussion about high finance. We have to try to focus on the most vulnerable. And what the G20 agreed to was to support the creation of these funds. We've got some initial contributions by the British and the Dutch. But frankly, we're going to need more, and we're going to need more support. And that's one of the things that I'm going to be trying to urge with the ministers that will be coming to Washington this weekend.
Well, this is going to sound uncharitable, but at a time when political leaders, finance ministers, and heads of state are facing immense political pressure in their own countries to do something about their own economies, how do you convince people to take care of those less fortunate?
Well, it's much more than an issue of charity. Now, I mean, American people, for example, have always been very generous when people are in need. But the bigger issue is we're in a global crisis, and you're going to need a global solution. So growth in a number of the developing countries will also be important in getting the United States and Europe back on its feet. If you looked as we were heading into this crisis, one of the strongest parts of the U.S. economy was the export sector. So if you get infrastructure projects in the developing world, for example, some of those are going to buy capital goods from the United States and Europe. And so it's not just a question of generosity. It's a question of self-interest.
How optimistic are you that you're going to get what you need coming out of this weekend's meetings?
Well, I think given the stress that you pointed out in the developed world, it's not going to be easy. I think we build support as we go. And in our case, we already have the capital to do about an extra $100 billion of lending for some of the medium-income countries and low-median income, about $42 billion for the poorest. And if we can use that to mobilize resources from governments and the private sector in an area like trade liquidity, I think we can make an important dent at the problem. But frankly, this is an uncertain environment, and no one is certain how long this is going to last, how deep it's going to run. So we're going to have to keep flexible and be able to adjust to the new uncertain problems that arise.
Robert Zoellick, the president of the World Bank, thanks a lot for your time.
Happy to be with you.
President Obama was in Iowa today. He was plugging wind power and promising that the days of the United States dragging its feet on climate change are over. The House Energy and Commerce Committee debated legislation to limit greenhouse gas emissions. And union and environmental groups launched a $3 million ad campaign promoting jobs for the clean energy economy. If you happen to find yourself today with a severe case of green fatigue, don't worry about it. Earth Day is almost over. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jennifer Collins takes a look at all the hype.
If you're looking to go green this Earth Day, you've got options. You could buy a ticket for Disney's new movie Earth from Fandango. Then the two companies will plant a tree in Brazil. You could win a year of eco-friendly cleaning products from Seventh Generation. And there are these ads from one of PepsiCo's brands.
Sun chips from California are made with solar energy.
PepsiCo plans to roll out a chip bag you can throw on your compost pile by Earth Day next year. Spokeswoman Aurora Gonzalez says the marketing has already begun.
We showed the decomposing bag on American Idol last night. I'll tell you that people are excited to hear about our steps in packaging.
But environmentalists say Earth Day has become a commercial free-for-all, just like Valentine's or Mother's Day. Green marketing expert Scott Case says some products, including that chip bag, may not be as green as they sound.
These kinds of compostable bags do not decompose. They do not compost in a landfill. And so this is a situation where consumers think that means a lot more than it actually does.
And he says that's dangerous as the market for sustainable products balloons. He says most of the year, ads for earth-friendly products account for 4% of advertising. But every April, that spikes to around 10%. Chip Giller is the president of the online environmental magazine, Grist.
Too many people kind of tokenize Earth Day, using it for an excuse to maybe hug a tree one day and ram it with their SUV the next.
But Giller and other environmentalists say corporate efforts do make a difference. They just don't go far enough in cutting emissions.
It's going to take a more hands-on effort, and it actually might mean consuming less. And I just don't see that message spreading across society.
To find out if it might, tune in next Earth Day. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Well, Won't sound good on radio, but here's a 140-character introduction to a story about executives who use Twitter. Padmasri Warrior, hello.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so now that I've done that Twitter thing and kept my introduction short, you have to tell us who you are.
I am the Chief Technology Officer for Cisco Systems.
And you, I guess, what is the word? You tweet, right?
I tweet, yes.
Okay, but why?
I tweet because it allows me to have conversations with people that I don't normally have in the course of my day.
So what do you tweet about? Read me your latest tweet if you happen to have it there.
Oh, I don't know if I have it directly in front of me, but I tweet about a combination of things related to Cisco, related to the industry, and some that are personal.
Now, does this do anything for your business?
I can't say it does things directly to benefit the business, but it does things indirectly to support some of the thought leadership, some of the innovative ideas that Cisco is considering. I propose questions, I ask people for their input, and I get a lot of ideas back from people.
Have you ever gotten anything that you took to a meeting and everybody said, oh man, that's a great idea?
Absolutely. I actually used something in the recent keynote that I did at a VoiceCon conference. I asked people about the future of collaboration, what their predictions were about how collaboration would look like in the future. People sent me lots of ideas. I created a word cloud out of that. In fact, one of my followers on Twitter created it for me, and I used that as part of my keynote, and it helped shape our strategy around collaboration.
So you're getting your followers on Twitter to, you know, do your job for you.
In a way.
In a way.
Why not? That is the future of social media and collaboration.
You said you use this for some personal things as well, right?
Yeah, I share personal things about movies I've seen, books I'm reading, what I'm doing at the moment, ask people for ideas.
Do you find it hard, though, to balance your personal observations, as much as they can be expressed in 140 characters, with your role as a senior executive of a very important company in this country?
It's not that difficult. I mean, I would say a lot of it is common sense, how much you want to share about your personal life openly with the world, where I have 250,000 followers or something. I think a lot of it is your judgment on what you feel comfortable sharing and what you feel you shouldn't share.
Do you really have 250,000 followers?
Something like that.
Now, you know, Ashton Kutcher's got a million, so you have a
ways
to go yet.
I know. Well, he's a Hollywood star.
Well, that's right. And you're just a tech person, right?
I'm just a CTO.
Padmasri Warrior, the CTO at Cisco Systems. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, kids and companies in the classroom.
You know, I hear from teachers a lot. These materials come in, they're free, they're colorful, they're engaging. You know, what am I supposed to do?
But first, let's do the numbers. Things were up all day, but tumbled at the bell. The Dow Industrials dropped 82 points, 1%, finished at 78.86. The NASDAQ squeaked up 2 points, 0.1%, closed at 1646. The S&P 500 fell 6 points, 0.75%, ended the day at 843. Here's your financials update. Bank of America fell 5.75%. Wells Fargo shaved off more than 3%. Morgan Stanley gave up almost 9% on some disappointing earnings. Today's bad news for Roche that Janet Babin told you about led to a 10% drop on the Swiss exchange. Fellow drugmaker Merck dropped 2% back here. Pfizer was down 3.5%. Ford drove up more than 12% today after Goldman Sachs upgraded the carmaker stock to buy. Chipotle Mexican Grill saw first quarter income rise by nearly half. That had its stock up by 5.5%. Today, bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.94%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by DreamWorks Pictures, presenting The Soloist, starring Robert Downey Jr. and Jamie Foxx, in theaters everywhere April 24th. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for March. A House Subcommittee on Health, Employment, Labor, and Pensions examines ways to reduce the cost of health insurance for employers, employees, and their families. And kids go to work with you, that is. Tomorrow is Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Next Wednesday is going to be a big day for the Obama administration. There won't be anything formal to mark the occasion, probably, but the honeymoon is officially going to be over. Commentator Robert Reich offers this early report card on the president's first 100 days.
As a university professor, I'm accustomed to giving grades. So here's how I'd grade Obamanomics so far. The 10-year budget gets an A. It's an extraordinary vision of what America can and should become, including universal health insurance and environmental protections against climate change. And the budget takes a little bit more from the rich and gives a little bit more back to the poor and lower middle class, which seems appropriate given that the income gap is wider than it's been since the 1920s. I'd give the budget an A+, except for its far too rosy economic projections. The stimulus package gets a B. Good as far as it goes, but doesn't go nearly far enough. $787 billion over 2 years sounds like a lot of stimulus, but the economy is operating at about $1.5 trillion below its capacity this year alone. And considering that the states are cutting services and increasing taxes to the tune of $350 billion over this year and next, the stimulus is way too small. The last grade is for the bank bailouts. I give them an F. I'm a big fan of this administration, but I've got to be honest, the bailouts are failing. So far, American taxpayers have shoveled out almost $600 billion, yet the banks are lending less money than they did 5 months ago. Their toxic assets and non-performing loans are growing, bank executives are still taking home princely sums, and the banks are still cooking their books. And now the Treasury is talking about converting taxpayer dollars into bank equity, which exposes taxpayers to even greater losses. So that's the report card, an A on the budget, B on the stimulus, and F on the bailout. On the whole, that gives Obamanomics a C+. Not bad given the magnitude of the problems he inherited. But by the same token, not nearly good enough.
Robert Reich gives out other grades to his students while he's teaching public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There's a huge branding conference happening in London today, all about how companies can better market their products to students. The website doesn't say exactly which students, though, college or maybe high school, we'd figure. But Marketplace's Sean Cole tells us companies are getting their brands in front of students who are a lot younger in the classroom.
There's this guy I know at member station WBUR here in Boston.
I'm an anchor reporter here.
Steve Brown. He's on the air a lot. And one night recently, he came home to find a note that his 11-year-old daughter had brought home from school. It said all of the fifth graders would be taking a puberty education class called Always Changing.
And then I get to the paragraph saying, and this is funded by Old Spice deodorant and Always feminine products.
Turns out the curriculum is provided free of charge by Procter & Gamble, which makes Always pads and Old Spice and Secret deodorants. It's a 1 to 2 hour class covering personal hygiene and menstruation. It was developed in 1984 and now reaches 85% of America's fifth graders.
And I thought schools were sort of an advertising-free zone.
I called the school to ask if I could sit in on the class. They said no, but...
All right, we have... package here.
Procter & Gamble sent me the curriculum. It comes with a sample pack that's handed out to the girls called
Your Happy Kit.
With the Always logo on the front. It's got pads and panty liners in it. There are also pamphlets and coupons.
And a little thing of secret. Invisible solid. Cuckoo cocoa butter is the scent.
The boys get a little thing of Old Spice. So is this education or is it marketing? Susan Lin, who heads up the campaign for a commercial-free childhood in Boston, says it's marketing.
Companies love to market in schools, and one of the ways that they do that is by creating what are called sponsored education materials, SEMs.
There's like an acronym for it?
Yes, and there are a wide variety of them.
From the American Coal Foundation and McDonald's and Clorox, and no for-profit enterprise, says Lynn, can possibly provide unbiased information about its field. I showed her part of the video that comes with the Procter & Gamble curriculum. The scene is little Megan's sleepover, and little Allison wanders away to the bathroom. She stands there, staring blankly. Enter Megan's mom.
Hey, Allison, is there something you need?
I don't know. I just started my period.
Oh.
Her first period. Dutifully, Megan's mom fishes out a package of Always brand pads and grabs a pair of clean undies from a laundry basket.
It's really easy. They stick right on your underwear.
The Always package is clearly visible throughout this shot.
And that's the whole purpose of this video, really. If it wasn't the purpose of the video, they wouldn't have product placement in it.
Honestly, in this company, as cheesy as it can sound sometimes, we go beyond just the products that we sell to really understanding how to help the consumer behind the products.
Leela Coffey is an associate marketing director for Always, but she says marketing is 100% not the intent of the curriculum. Puberty is scary, and P&G wants to help. And sure, there might be some corporate benefit.
It would be disingenuous of me to say that we don't believe that benefit is there. But if we were choosing to directly market at these girls, I think the program would look a lot different than it does.
The branding would be more blatant, she says. But Susan Lin isn't convinced. And Lin says, in this economy, underfunded schools might make room for more sponsored materials.
You know, I hear from teachers a lot. These materials come in, they're free, they're colorful, they're engaging. You know, what am I supposed to do?
Question is, intentional or not, do they work as marketing? Will Steve Brown's daughters grow up to use Always and Secret?
My wife has trained them well. They will use what's on sale.
In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace. This story was brought to you by the makers of candles, broccoli, and finger paint.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, in keeping with the observance of Earth Day, and by observance, I really do mean observance, the satellite television company Dish Network launched a new channel today, Dish Earth, it's called. Live views of the Blue Planet 24 hours a day. No word if it's a basic offering or a premium channel, and you can buy still pictures, too, should you be so inclined. All the same, kind of reminds me of that old Yule log telecast they used to run at Christmas time. A log in a Christmas fire all day long. Our day is done. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 82 points, 1%. The Nasdaq rose 2 points. That's a 10th percent. The S&P 500 added 2 points. That is one-third of 1 percentage point there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Coming up next time on the broadcast, watching a small town hit the skids.
You have this almost crushing sense. How are you going to be able to get these people into jobs, and how quickly can you do it?
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.